Is Iran's highest mountain higher than Mount Everest?
دماوند از اورست بلندتر است؟
نه. اورست از دماوند بلندتر است. اورست بلندترین کوه دنیا است.
I'm now joined by Mr. Jahanshah Javid, founder, creator and main force behind Iranian.com, for whom the strapline is "Nothing is sacred." Thank you for coming to join us today, Mr. Javid.
Nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, you've come all the way from Mexico.
I have.
I must say, if I had a mobile business, I probably would pick somewhere hot and lovely to live.
Well, I used to live in Northern California, and I'm ashamed to say this, but I got sick of Iranians and Iranian events in San Francisco. So I went somewhere that there are no Iranians and no Iranian events.
Wow.
So I can only concentrate on the site itself.
But that is very Iranian in itself.
Is it?
Yes.
To avoid Iranians?
It's a massively diverse site, and I've been looking at it more and more over the past few months, even when I didn't know I was going to meet you. And what really struck me about it is how democratic it is. The content is uploaded directly. The comments come and go forth, you know, so it's kind of created by the people. But there is a main core which you yourself sort of monitor. Tell us about that part, please.
Well, before this site became interactive, for like almost 12 or 13 years, it was only me getting the content by email through various volunteers and readers and putting them manually onto the site. But in the past 2 or 3 years, it's become like a publishing system where people can have their own blogs and so forth. So we have a section that's become very popular, which is the blog section. But I still have in the middle of the site on the front page, more heavy-duty articles from people who are professional writers or academics and so forth. So I select those as well.
Do you commission them?
That's the thing about Iranian.com. I never ask anyone to write anything. It's just people send it by themselves.
You don't need to.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate, yeah. So I get like 2 or 3 articles a day, but what I do is I publish 4 every other day. So I make a selection based on what comes in. I don't put everything in there, so there's kind of a selection.
It's amazing, because when I think about, you know, the need for people to publish, and you're doing it both in Persian script and in English, it really echoes back to my mind how disparate the Iranian community is. Obviously, after 79, a huge amount of people left. And obviously, those numbers have increased as they've had children and so on. And more people have left. And I think that a place like that, in this virtual world where they can all meet and converge, it speaks for itself. It's something that they've desperately needed to do. You must be very good at web development, because there's some really interesting things you can do on your website. So if you're looking at someone's uploaded photos of their artwork, you can send it as a photo e-card.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
What other quirky things you got going?
Well, recently we've added a feature underneath all the pages where you can actually follow the comments. Like, you don't have to go back to the page to see what new comments there are. You click on something, and then whenever there's a new comment on that page that you're interested in, it'll email it to you, and then you can go and see it. So you don't really have to constantly go and check it by yourself manually. I think that's a kind of neat thing. Similar to what Facebook has, if somebody poked you or whatever, you get an email.
I hate that. What do you mean you poked me? In English, also, it's a rather risque way of saying it, isn't it?
Well, it's an American thing. I don't know what it means here, but...
Well, I'll let you imagine.
So that's one of the things we did. And also, the one you mentioned, you know, sending photos by email, it was actually something developed by another site, and they were trying to promote their services. They installed that for us in order to get some traffic for themselves. So it was kind of an exchange with that site, and it's been quite a popular thing.
Now, when you come to the front page, it's all about interactivity and about accessibility. It's very readable. A lovely overview of the site. There doesn't seem to be any advertising. So how are you making a living?
There are advertising on the left column and also on the top, the banners. And usually they're either direct ads that we receive from various businesses, or we have such things as Google ads. And that's been very helpful for us, because it's... Well, I don't know why it's not showing it, but,
maybe we've got a clever...
I saw it this morning. Maybe they have a firewall here or something.
Yes.
I'm not sure.
We don't like
but,
ads.
Yeah, maybe. No. I'm not... That's disturbing.
That's nice.
You should see ads.
No, if you're clever, you know how to block them, especially, you know, things on MySpace. They've got so many pop-ups.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
die.
Good thing that, you know, MySpace is almost history, and Facebook is taking over.
I don't know if that's a good thing, actually, because for musicians to have a place to showcase your music.
Well, they can still showcase on Facebook, on
it's
YouTube.
Not the same.
I mean, I only go to YouTube and Facebook and, you know, Irani.com and the BBC. And that's actually, I don't know, we're getting off topic, but despite the millions and millions of websites that exist today and all the choices you have, I think still most people only go to 4 or 5 sites a day. I mean, they've stuck with certain number of newspapers.
When I go on, all the musicians are online on MySpace. You know, and I think that's important for them somehow.
It is, absolutely.
Yeah, it's have that page. And it's become perfectly acceptable to be, as it would be on Iranian.com. I know a couple of people have contacted me and said, oh yeah, I write on Iranian.com. But it's not their full-time job. You know, it's not a paid job. Just as MySpace is not really an official website, something you've got for free and you've formatted.
Right.
So I like this dissolving of the barriers between what's acceptable and what's not. So you must be helping a lot of people.
I hope I am. I think mostly it's people who are really, really missing Iran, because most Iranians who left Iran after the revolution was kind of a forced exile. Nobody really wanted to leave, but because of the government in Iran and the extremism there and the lack of opportunities and so forth, they had to leave for one reason or another. And when they came here, it was kind of a shock to be broken away from their culture and their homeland and so forth. So obviously, I'm sure you know that Iranians are super nationalistic about whatever Iranian it is. And I think the main reason for that is just they miss home. And I think that reflects also in people who come to Iranian.com. They get a lot of times when non-Iranians see the site, they say, you know, this is really kind of extreme in terms of only caring about Iran or only caring about it.
Not really. I mean, we have a national station in England paid for by the government through our taxes, which is BBC Asian Network.
Right.
And they cater only for the Asian community,
right,
doing shows in their multiple languages, sometimes in English, with news and personalities, and they're there at every event. You know, so they have, in their numbers, justified the need for that.
That's true.
So anyone who looks at that site, just send them to BBC Asian Network.
Right.
Who says that? Sorry. Doesn't make
That's
sense.
True.
I am
That's
incensed
true.
That there's not something, you know, a little bit stronger for Iranians here.
Right. Actually, that's one of the reasons that I started Irani.com, because 15 years ago when, you know, I was working for various news agencies, and then I wanted to start my own magazine, but it was very expensive to print one. And also it was very difficult to distribute it among a community that's all over the place, and they don't have a distribution network, and it was very difficult to post it to them and so forth. And plus, Iranians are not the type to really buy a newspaper. You know, they haven't grown up in a culture where media is respected, and you there are lots of variety and so forth. So it was a blessing that the internet came along, and then I was able to put it on the internet, and I saw a vacuum for Iranians to have a media of themselves, to be able to express themselves. And also, more importantly, to express themselves freely, because, you know, in their history, they've lacked that. And for the first time, the internet has allowed us to speak about what we think exactly.
That's a really lovely, as you mentioned, the freedom of it is a really lovely aspect of it, in contrast to what you just referred to, you know, the history of Iranians and the media.
And still, I mean, we constantly hear about the media in Iran, and Iran's number two in the number of journalists jailed these days.
What's number one?
China.
Right.
Yeah. So it's still a very, very bad situation there, you know, even for bloggers and the new media over there. And, you know, constantly we hear about newspapers being shut down and so forth. And also about even the BBC and other foreign broadcasters being
blocked.
Yeah.
I've had a look at the equipment that they've been using to block the broadcasts. It's really interesting.
Really?
Yeah, with the desert in the background, it looks like something very lunar.
Well, I was speaking to some of the BBC Persian people yesterday, and they were saying that actually, apparently, you can bypass and see the BBC, but if they change the angle of their dish, they can do that. But the negative side is that they lose a lot of other popular channels if they do that. So many people won't just shift it to watch the BBC, because they want to see a lot of other channels as well.
Right. You need to develop a little mechanism that rotates your satellite for you in your home, so you can do it with the joystick.
I'm sure somebody will invent that.
I can see it now, a huge set of apartments with dishes all waving in the wind.
It's very true.
So you've linked up recently with Kudum,
I've seen,
to get the events really off the road. That's exciting. Who are they?
They are a couple of guys who are based in Pennsylvania.
Yes, we like them because I've just clicked on them. My events first.
Oh, it's up there?
Six Pillars is
there
number one on the events.
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah, it's really, really a good system that they've devised. And wherever you live, it automatically brings up the events in your city. So if you're in Los Angeles, it'll bring up, you know, things in, you know, over there, or in London, it will bring up events here. And it's very, you know, very nicely designed as well. It's really, really cool. So
they wrote to me and said, can you help us promote it? But where are they in America, you said?
They are in the US. They're in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so they said that they're using computers, robots, to monitor the internet and sift out news. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's been any like major bloopers that way.
I'm not sure. Because this is an automatic page, I don't go there often to see if there are any mistakes or not. But I haven't seen any complaints or anything. And every time
I think it would be fun to see that the computers, the robots have picked up this crazy bit of news. For whatever reasons, they're selecting the news. Because obviously, by contrast to your site, you know, it's very human. It's very manually done.
Mm-hmm.
For example, here you've got on the side Iranians of the Day.
Yes, one of my favorite pages.
Right, who does that?
I select it, yeah. But the funny thing about it is that when you say Iranian of the Day, you would expect that they're the best of Iranians. But no, you have rotten ones as well. I keep telling people, because I still get comments like, why is this person Iranian of the Day? And I say, well, Iranians come in various, characters.
Warts and all.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what I think makes it fun. And I mean,
not a culture that likes to admit that, you know, we have blemishes. And
exactly.
Things,
yeah. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I had Commander Dizai as Iranian of the Day.
Who's that? Tell us.
Well, he's the police commissioner in London who was convicted for 4 years for...
For
bullying an Iraqi-born British gentleman for not paying £600 to develop his website.
Right.
And then he claimed that he had been stabbed with a shisha glass, and apparently it was self-inflicted, or that was what he was convicted of. Yeah, so the Iranian Day is not necessarily for people who are, you know, successful. It's also for people who are just in the news.
So you could compare it to kind of a school, you know, Christian-based school. We had Thought for the Day. Mm-hmm. So you could say it's almost something where, okay, it might be someone who needs you to have your attention on them today because they're in a pickle.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Even if it's a self-inflicted pickle. Yeah.
And by contrast, yesterday we had someone who, we had an honorary Iranian of the Day. She's a person who worked for Amnesty International throughout these 8 months that were protests in Iran and in the U.S. She was very active in trying to get the news out to organize various protests online. So somebody suggested that we should have her as the honorary Iranian of the Day. So we had her picture there with a green scarf and everything.
Did she get notified that she is?
Oh, she knew about it. Yeah. It was not, you know, we didn't do that arbitrarily.
Yeah, because it's a shame if they miss that.
Oh, yeah. No, she knew. Absolutely, yeah. And, and we have other sections that are called nostalgia. We have, you know, we find a lot of clips on YouTube of old Iranian movies, and we have a lot of photo essays that are of travelers who go to Iran. There's always a fruit stall or goats and sheep and camels and all of that. We never get tired of those.
No, and long may they live. You know, the day Iran looks like a high street from any of the major cities in England, I think I'll really feel depressed. Yeah. So it's very exciting. It's got lots of elements and it's got embedded audio, which is good. Do you have any licensing problems with that streaming?
No, no problem with that. Most of our traffic for the music is for the music videos that we find on YouTube. And actually, our music, quote unquote, store has not been very successful. People just refuse to buy anything. But other than that, it has, you know, one of the biggest archives of Iranian music of all kinds, classical, pop, and that sort of thing.
Well, they don't have copyright in Iran.
They don't have copyright, but also those who do have copyright, they kind of see it as a promotion of their work. So, you know, we've had almost no complaints about putting music from various artists in there.
No, why would you? No, I was just thinking, why did people refuse to pay? So obviously they come from a culture where, you know, you can just...
Everything's free.
You should just nick it.
Right. Yeah, so it's one of the biggest music pages. And also, other than the front page, music section is our most popular.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in you now. Obviously, you've come from a journalist background. How did you get into journalism?
I came to the U.S. for high school. And 4 years later, when I graduated, a year had passed since the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much into the revolutionary fever and so forth. And immediately I went back and I wanted to
Everyone else was running away. You went back.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes. I wanted to join the revolution and all that nonsense. And I did. And a year after I went to Iran, I got hired as a translator for the Iranian news agency, the Islamic Republic news agency.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was very much involved in supporting that whole thing. But I guess, fortunately, several years later, I came to my senses. Basically, my journalism career started in Iran as a translator, and then slowly I moved away. And then in 1990, I came back to the U.S. and went to college. Yeah, and again, studied journalism, media studies in New Mexico and New York. After that, when I graduated, I started Iranian.com.
I can totally see why at the time the revolution must have seemed like a viable option. You know, if you're unhappy, you opt for change, don't you?
Right.
And sometimes change doesn't appear as it is going to be. You know, just as Mussolini once said, you know, oh, I support Hitler and so on. It's something at the time it seems attractive because you don't really know what it is.
Right. No, and also I think back then I was 18, 19 when this happened with no knowledge of politics or, you know, what it means to have a democracy or not. And back then there was actually no major political faction that spoke about democracy.
Right.
It was either socialism or Islam or the monarchy. And I think that human rights and individual rights were never talked about. There was not a, you know, a priority for anyone. And I think that was the biggest mistake that forces back then made. I think that's still the problem that the Iranian revolution, the Iranian Islamic Republic is facing today.
Yeah.
And one of the positive things about the Green Movement today in Iran is that it's very democratic and it insists on individual freedoms and this sort of thing and secularism.
Right. So there's been a kind of evolution in the public's consciousness.
Absolutely. I think that's a very, very positive change.
Yeah.
So, but in terms of journalism, I think I try to reflect and see what I got out of it when I was in Iran. And I tell people that we have an expression in Iran. It says, adab az ke ambukhti az bi adaban, which means, how did you learn your manners? And you learned it from bad people. So I try to be positive. I know all the horrible types of journalism that existed there that I followed. And I learned from it. I knew it was a big mistake. And I'm trying to repay my debt to that society with Iranian.com, with the absolute reverse of that.
If it hadn't been you, it would have been someone else.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you could get the chance to go back, would you have not worked for the revolution?
Absolutely not, yeah.
You'd have changed that.
But, you know, what's done is done. And I try to insist in my blogs that for younger people today, a lesson for them today is not to follow individuals, but to follow principles. And someone is nonviolent, that's the one to go by. And someone who believes in democratic principles in action, not just in words. And if they don't follow that, you have no responsibility to stick with them. I think the Iranian youth today are much, much more advanced in their political thinking than we were. Simply because they have, you know, these days access to the internet and the international community and thoughts that are universal, which we didn't have back then. And also, they've grown in a society that's been closed and repressive. So that has also taught them that, you know, this is not the way for the future. So I think that's a very positive sign.
Do you think that it was a kind of surge in the embracing of Islam, or was that already there? I mean, I wasn't there at the time, and neither were you, but you knew the people of that era. And do you think that there was a surge of interest in Islam, or was it already
absolutely,
there?
Absolutely, absolutely. There was a surge in belief in Islam, because actually, after the 1953 coup, the religious segments of society were encouraged and left alone to act as sort of a buffer against communism.
Who was doing that encouraging?
The government, yeah. Because the first Pahlavi Shah actually was the person who initially was very much against religious establishment, and he forced women not to wear the hijab.
Yes.
Yeah, but by force. Mm. And also a lot of religious schools were shut down. But after the 53 coup, this kind of reversed and the religious establishment became very, very powerful.
Do you think that was because everything that had been developing, you know, a yearning for modernism and a secular society was given a slap in the face with the coup, and the Iranians themselves thought, okay, let's go back to our roots, which are more religious, as opposed to this American dream
of... Well, I think that was partly so. I think secularism and modernism by itself were not the negative aspects of the government, but it was the authoritarian and dictatorial nature of it. Mm. I mean, if we had a democracy that was modern and secular, I don't think we would have had a revolution. Mm. I think the Shah, his biggest mistake was that he pushed away all his enemies, even those who were moderate and not extremist religious types. So by the time the revolution happened, there was no secular force in sight to lead the people and to be an alternative to the religious ones. Mm. So the religious forces were back then left alone, and they were very powerful. And they were seen as the only alternative to the Shah, because everybody else had been discredited and pushed back or cooperating with the dictatorship.
Right.
So it was only the religious establishment that could had a foothold and a popularity among the public. But obviously, since the revolution, we've had the experience with the religious types and what's happened with them.
Mm.
So I think they also have been just as discredited widely, just as the Shah was. So.
Yeah, we had a couple of British journalist presenters on radio who were working for Press TV, and one of them, a very high-profile one, stopped working for them during the elections. But another one, George Galloway, he's still working for them, right? But anyway, I'm really interested in what you said, because it occurs to me that the mistrust that grew with things Western after the 53 coup
mm-hmm.
may have been responsible for this fostering of the Islamic pockets within society. And therefore, sort of in a weirdly angled way, America and Britain, who deposed Mossadegh, might be responsible for the state of Iran now.
Probably, yes. But I insist, I think it was not just the modern or Western aspect of the Shah's policies.
No, but they associated, you know, people in their mind associated
those things. Well, yeah, it got, I think, unfairly bundled up with dictatorship.
It was black or white, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we have the example of Turkey that for all these years they've been modernized, westernized and so forth. But parallel to that, they've built a democracy. And I think they've shown that an Islamic society, you know, with a population of majority of Muslims can be democratic, same as Malaysia. And you also have the example of Indonesia. They were under a dictatorship for a very long time, but it's a Muslim majority country that these days is a democratic country, or at least not so far. We haven't seen a major shift by the people to go and promote an Islamic government. This very small minority does. But I think in any society, be it Muslim or otherwise, if you take the option away of a democratic choice, then the extremists will take over. And I think the reason why Turkey, Malaysia, and other examples that I mentioned have so far been successful is because of their institutional democracy. And I think we need that not only in Iran, we need that in Saudi Arabia, we need that in Egypt, and a lot of other Muslim countries. And this excuse that if we have free elections that Muslims will take over, I think is a fallacy. I think if you give people choice, they won't go for extremists.
Right. So obviously the people in power wouldn't want to give people free choice.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. They keep on to power, and then the extremists, you know, try to get rid of them by force, and then you have a much more, you know, repressive society after that. So it's a policy, unfortunately, that the United States and Western governments still follow, that, you know, they still support Saudi Arabia and a lot of repressive governments in the Muslim countries because, quote unquote, they're afraid of fundamentalists taking over. But I think that's exactly why fundamentalists become popular, because they're under a dictatorship. They're under unpopular dictatorships. And if democracy is not introduced, you'll have a much worse society after that.
It's interesting to hear you speak. I mean, you're obviously very interested in these topics. Your life is spent on the web.
Yeah, too much.
Yes. And this is your labor
absolutely.
Of love. It's your child.
Yes.
It's a wonderful creation.
So. Yeah.
So I wondered, what sites do you frequent? What are your favorite sites?
I do visit the BBC World Service a lot. And I do visit The Guardian, you know, several times a week. And, you know, lots of YouTube and this sort of thing.
Nothing American?
Well, sometimes I visit the New York Times.
Yes.
But rarely.
Yes.
But the American news bores me.
Yes. So you're going for English sites? Well, we're very honored.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think British journalism is much more exciting and direct and honest than American journalism.
Why do you think British journalism is exemplary then?
I'm not sure why. I've always been a fan of British journalism simply because, I don't know, they're much more direct. in discussing things than the Americans are much more polite and indirect.
Yes.
So I don't know. I remember when I first went back to Iran and became a journalist there, they sent me here for a journalism course at the University of London, that a summer course for like 2 months for Muslim journalists.
Oh.
Yes. But all the teachers were, you know, newspaper editors from here who were taking these summer jobs and teaching.
What decade was that then?
This was in 1983.
Right.
Yeah. And I was just, I learned in that 2 months everything I needed for basic journalism. And I really, really admired their skill and the basic things that they taught me. And I think it was from there that I tried to actually be a, quote, good Muslim journalist. To, you know, if we're having a society that's Islamic, it doesn't mean that we can't speak the truth. It doesn't mean that we can't talk about negative things that happen in society.
No, why should it?
Yeah. But obviously, I couldn't do that.
Right.
So in that society, at least. The newspapers here taught me a lot about what it means to appreciate freedom of expression and First Amendment rights, which are in the U.S. and so forth. And from there, it helped me build ideas that eventually came into Iranian.com and Nothing is Sacred and all that. Yeah.
You're kind of ripping down the walls of some of what you learned in a way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All the time. All the time trying to...
Very interesting headlines when you leave it to the people.
Oh, the news headline?
Any of the headlines that they come up with, any of the titles, they're very creative. I like that. It's an interesting model. I wonder who's going to pick up on it soon.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you something. In Europe, we have a language barrier, so we can't really watch other press agencies. Sometimes they have a widget on the page where you can translate.
Right.
There is this language barrier, but we're known in Europe, in Britain, for being polite.
Right.
So compared to Americans, we're probably a lot more direct. But within Europe, the French think that we're just PC bound.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Stiff upper lip.
I can't tell.
I have some musicians over from France last night, and again in the streets they were railing against these Muslim dressed men on the other side.
Right.
And I said, you just can't do that. That's just not PC. And
over
I had
here?
To explain PC. And then they're just not ashamed to say what they think. I mean, it's reflected in the government, isn't it? They banned the burqa.
Well, I mean, in this specific case that you're mentioning, it might actually border racism.
Right, it might do.
Yeah.
But then in England, we believe people have the right to express their racism. Look at the BNP. We tolerate intolerance in Europe.
Political parties can, but newspapers, it wouldn't be acceptable if you started, you know, criticizing Muslim women just because they're wearing a scarf.
Mm.
That wouldn't be acceptable.
But France isn't criticizing them as much. They're just saying, if you want to enjoy France, you've got to dress a bit more like us.
Well, I mean, the public may speak that way, but for a newspaper to actually...
What about a government to promote that by law?
Well, I think it was a mistake for the French to recently propose a law that only affected 1,000 women in the whole country.
Yeah, but it's a standard by which they'd like to progress in the future.
Right.
They're not trying to infringe these women's rights as much as say, this is how I interpret it, as just to say, in France... We want to see people's faces. We can't have these people going around looking like ninjas. And, you know, we're a society that identifies people through their faces.
I understand that. But to institute a law that only covers 1,000 people in the entire nation, I think is provocative rather than effective.
But maybe someone's gone to the Prime Minister there and said...
I'm sure they have.
Yeah, I haven't finished. And they say, figures show that the influx of Muslims to France... You know, look at England by comparison, is going to rise. So how are we going to deal with this? How do you want to set out the parameters of this influx of people? And he must have said, OK, fine, they can be here, but they just got to look a bit more accessible.
Right. Well, my own belief is that I think the government should ban Muslim families from forcing the hijab on children.
But that, how do you know when they forced it? And it's such a nanny state question, isn't it?
Well,
what if the children want it?
It's like, you know, you cannot stop a child from going to school.
Right.
And it's the same thing. If you see a child that's wearing the hijab, it's not by choice.
You see, that's so dangerous.
Why would that be dangerous?
Because we have a nanny state pretty much in UK. You know, they tell you how to look after children.
Right.
And there are certain things that you can't really decide legally. Where is the border between the child wanting to emulate the mother and look like the mother?
No, but they can do that when they're 18.
Yeah, but
you know,
at seven,
or an adult.
At seven, you're trying on your mum's clothes, right?
That's true.
You want to look like mummy.
That's true, but I think, I don't know.
I understand what you're saying, but it's so dangerous to say, parents, children, you can't do this.
But again, what's the limit? And the family says, well, we want to have clitoral circumcision done because our religion says so.
And the child wants to be like mummy.
If that's yes, no, I mean... So I don't see, I think the institution of the hijab on girls changes the life so much.
Yes.
That I think it's a real crime, because I think that's a decision that an adult should make. And when you do that on a child that young, it stays with her forever.
Dangerous territory there, because, yeah, you know, there's Jewish circumcision, everything,
yeah,
under that,
right,
umbrella. But it is,
right,
a very interesting topic, which we, mm-hmm, probably shouldn't get into.
Oh, I'm sure we'll be talking this for decades.
It would be lovely if everyone evolved quickly and suddenly.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. Everything's gradual, you know, whether it's in Iran or elsewhere. And it's only by public debates and blogging,
yes,
and all that, and these kinds of discussions that we evolve. But it takes time.
Great. Well, it's so interesting to hear from you. And I wonder, where would you like to see Iranian.com go in the future?
People ask me that, and my only answer is that I have no idea, because I'm comfortable with what it is, and I don't have any big plans to do anything else with it for the future.
No, I'm not talking, you know, in actual fact, but if you could shut your eyes,
right,
sitting on your deck chair there in Mexico, drinking your pina colada, and imagine, would you like to see Iranian.com as a broadsheet in every Iranian home, or as a university, or as a journalism school one day, you know,
right,
something like that?
Right. Oh, yeah, I think I'd love to teach one day journalism, online journalism. But as a broadsheet, I think that's history. I don't think any newspaper is going to survive as a print anymore.
Oh, what are we going to read on the tube?
You're going to have the iPad.
Ugh. Never.
You're going to have the free standard newspaper.
Yes.
The Metro and so forth.
Well, the Standard's taken over. They've just included so much positive news.
Oh, they have?
They have. And it's such a better, you know, standard of journalism than the clear pits and things that they put for the Metro.
Mm-hmm.
The Metro were owned by the Daily Mail. It's the same.
Is it?
Yeah, it's
really?
The same Associated Press.
Right. No, it's just the economics of it is so difficult. And
yeah,
I think it's going to be only read by people who are on the tube and so forth. But in general, circulation is going down, down, down. And it's going to, I think, eventually die out.
Mm.
A lot of it, yeah.
Well, then when we think about that, what's going to happen to the planet if every home has the internet, every child has a laptop?
I think it's the most beautiful thing ever.
But what are we going to do with all the thrown away laptops and all the cabling and everything? Is it ecologically viable?
Well, that is a problem that has to be dealt with. But in terms of communication and in,
yeah,
terms of connectivity and this universal media that's been created by individuals, I think that's a really, really positive thing. And I see it as everybody being able to touch each other through electronic medium. And I think that's always positive, to be able to go cross cultures.
For sure. And
yeah,
to get such an amazing input into your life. It saves you from having this really blinkered life.
Mm-hmm.
There's been at times when I've left the computer and gone into the street and my mind is still kind of connected. And I've imagined that.
Are you texting?
No, I'm not texting. In my mind, I'm texting. So what I see is updating my status in my mind. It's ridiculous. It's a new experience for me. I'm frightened of becoming obsessed. And I imagine in the future something. I mean, I don't know if you've seen that film with Bruce Willis. It's called Surrogate.
No.
It's where it's set in the future where human beings, to avoid risk and danger, live at home and they send out a surrogate. And they're lying at home and mentally, through their mind, making this surrogate of themselves, which needn't be in their own shape. So,
mm-hmm,
you know, you might be a 20 stone man.
Right.
Using a slim blonde out in the world. And there's very, very few people who are actually going out in the world anymore.
Wow.
They're all at home. And you can, you know, at any time come away from the surrogate, but it's set in this future. And also, I was just thinking about the Facebook thing, you know, with this connectivity. It's frightening me, and it's a little bit technologically, I think, dangerous, what it's doing to our minds. And environmentally, I don't like it either. But then at the same time, I had this image of us one day moving to one large brain. It's like we're all going to be connected via this big server, and we're going to see something like that. How do you imagine the future?
Well, we're not going to be around, so we're not going to worry about it. We're going to have our little simple laptops for now. But
yeah,
it's definitely something to think about. But I think these things get sorted out as people get concerned about certain aspects of things.
Yeah.
And I think that can evolve positively. The negative aspects can always be weeded out eventually. But there are obviously certain things that are unconscious that we're not thinking about. We're just doing without thinking about it. And that's the ones that are probably dangerous.
That's usually justified by commerce. If it's economically viable, they go for it.
Right.
And they don't think about the consequences. It's very short-term thinking.
Right. Well, one of the things about, the great things about the internet is that a lot of individuals like myself, they don't need that much money to do what they're doing. So there might be big ones like Google and, you know, Facebook and Microsoft and so forth. But I think the vast majority of the internet is driven by individuals. So, and they're rarely after economic gain. Certainly I haven't gained much. But
you're scraping a living from Iranian.com.
Well, yeah, I'm able to survive because I live at my sister's house in Mexico.
Thanks to your sister.
Absolutely.
And donations are received
by
Iranian.com.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's been wonderful.
You got some charity funding at all?
No. Charity funding?
Yeah, some benevolent society.
Oh, no, just relatives. Just this weekend, I bought this camera for $500 and I got an email from another sister that said, I want to give you $500 for your birthday. So,
wow.
So it evened out, you know. I get that sort of thing from family a lot. I've had support from our readers as well, because a month ago we had a fundraising drive online and they donated $10,000. So
wow.
I wish that helped to fill our empty coffers. But
so what's brought you over to London this time?
Actually, for the longest time, I've had friends at the BBC Persian Service, the TV station, and they've expressed interest for me doing something for them. And I've always said no, but my resistance is weakening.
Right.
So I've come here to talk to them to see, you know, what possibilities may exist. But my condition is that I'm not going to give up Iranian.com. But parallel to that, if I can do something, I might do it.
Well, if you do get in there, the first thing you can do for us is translate it into English. I want that widget. It's not fair. What about all the Iranians who don't speak Persian? And I know so many.
Right,
you know,
right.
And
they do a very good job. It's a really good television program.
Well, I wouldn't know because it's all blah, blah, blah to
me. Really? You've forgotten it, really?
Like many Iranians I have.
Yeah. So you don't speak to your parents in Farsi at all, no?
My mum didn't even cook me Persian food till recently. You know, we tried so hard to adapt that there was this kind of long-lasting backlash.
Right.
And become really, really English.
Right.
I remember when I first came here, you know, that I had things like children speaking to me in the street and I had no idea what they were saying. Not helped by the fact that my mum had recently shaved my head in Iran to give me stronger hair.
Right.
Yeah, but I made friends with the kids in the street, and I remember a boy putting me on his bike, because in Iran at the time, you know, all my cousins would take me on a chopper.
Right.
You know, the little bikes. And I was getting on this boy's bike, and he said, "Don't put your feet in the spokes." But that was way too difficult a word for me. So I went, okay, just stuck my feet in the spokes.
Oh, goodness. You hurt yourself.
Oh. Yeah, I remember all these things. And I just said to my mum, "No, if you want me to shut the door, say it in English, because I'm English now. I've got to survive."
Absolutely. Well, you have.
Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Where can we find out more about your work? And I suppose it's all on Iranian.com.
Yeah, everything's on Iranian.com. I'm also on Facebook.
Do you have your own blog on there?
I do. I do have my blog. It's under Jahanshah Javid. And I think on average, I do like one blog a week. And our last one was quite controversial because it was called Gay Times. Yes, because we're having a gay comedy night in San Francisco in a couple of weeks.
I saw the poster for that. Ahmadinejad dressed
amazing?
As a queen.
Yes,
oh,
Queen Victoria.
I loved it. I showed it to all my friends.
Yes. So, but because of that, I've been accused of being gay. And first of all,
are you in denial then? Or are you denying?
Well, I got a few comments telling me I should come out of the closet, but I don't know. I'm still stuck there. I don't know. And the show is actually going to be in the Castro district of San Francisco.
Is someone going to film it?
We will. I hope that the comedians will allow us to do some clips.
Is it going to be all in Persian then?
No, actually, it's going to be all in English.
Great. Please.
Yes,
film
we'll
it
have
for
clips.
Us. Yeah. I want it all on film. Yeah. When we have an event like we're having one tonight, and we have a camera up front.
Yeah, I think it would be very easy to probably set up, you know, just a still camera and, you know, shoot directly. And
there was recently an exhibition of gay artists, Iranian artists in Berlin.
Oh, really?
It was called Iranian Bodies.
Right. Wow. I didn't hear about it. Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
Iranian Bodies. I think it's still on, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll check it out.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming. We'll see you tonight at the Amnesty event. And please, everyone, have a look at Iranian.com. See the wonderful work of Jahanshah Javid and everybody else around the world.
Thank you so much.